Hello, and welcome to another segment of Open House here at Community Media. I am Raymond Galker, and this is a show that we bring people in from the community that are doing great, great things to make our community better. And I have with us today Michael Nelson, who's with the Lomas Museum Center. Is that how it's said?
That's correct. Lomas Center Museum.
Okay, and that's in Gettysburg?
That is in Gettysburg.
And your position there is?
I'm the executive director.
The executive director. And aside of you, we have, I'd like to say my good friend. Can I call you a good friend?
Sure.
Okay. My good friend, Pete Sox. He's with Sockham's
Web Solutions, Sockham Web Solutions.
Sockham's Web Solution, and you also serve the community in what capacity in the government here?
Supervisor of Berwick Township.
Supervisor of Berwick Township. And you've been a supervisor there for how many years?
This is my 15th year.
15th year. And Berwick is a great friend of Community Media. We want to thank you so much. You're very generous. You share your franchise fee with Community Media so that we can provide shows like this and community programming. And that's what it was set up to do. And
yep.
And thank you guys for doing that.
You're welcome.
This desk is because of you guys. Right here, Pete. So today we're going to talk about the Lomas Center Museum, which is in Gettysburg, and I never knew this existed until Pete started to make connections with Community Media and you, Mike. Can you tell us about the Lomas Center?
Well, the Lomas Center Museum was founded in 2019, and it was designed originally to be the core collection by a gentleman named George Lomas, which is where the Lomas Center Museum gets its name. And he was quite a prolific collector. He owned a local sutlery business where reenactors could buy their uniforms and pieces. But the remarkable story about George is he was not a particularly educated man, and he wasn't a particularly well-read man, but I would say it would be hard-pressed to find someone in the community who would know more about Civil War guns and cannons than George did. So he had a very good eye as a collector, and the museum was kind of formed to house and showcase that collection and other objects as we acquire them.
So this was close to his heart.
This is very close to his heart. This is named after him, obviously, so it's a pretty fundamental consideration. And then it's also an important collection. We have some very interesting objects, and it's important that we as a museum, one of our functions is we keep things into public trust and maintain them. So there's conservation and ongoing preservation work on.
So you have his collection. Do you add to it, or is...
We do. One of the things that the museum has kind of changed since I came on board, which was 2021, when I came in, it was strictly a Civil War museum. We're expanding that now to cover all of American military history. So we cover everything from French and Indian conflicts, this Revolutionary War certainly, right up through what was going on with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. So we're covering all periods of warfare from American soldiers and fighting men and women.
So by covering it, you mean you have literature there, you have objects there?
Yes, that's a great thing. We do have, as a museum, of course, our foundation is objects. So we do have objects from all of those periods, even things from early OSS, which was the organization that became the CIA. So we have a lot of material about how that spy agency developed, and that was largely during World War II. But we have everything that covers Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War. A lot of things that we get comments on because there's still people alive who experienced that. So objects to look at and documents that we can share as well.
Well, that's sort of unique for this area, is it not?
It is. There's obviously the concentration of interest in Gettysburg is and will always be the Civil War. But we thought it important to expand that to cover all eras of military war, because the warriors who are the fighting men and women who defend our country, while very important during the Civil War, all of them deserve some recognition and all of them deserve to be remembered. And that's one of the functions of the museum, is to make sure we don't lose these memories of the people and the objects that they used.
And honor those individuals.
And honor them. It's a store situation where we are very much into honoring all veterans who have served from any branch. We even are in the process of putting up a large patch board where any military person can attach a patch that will stay on the museum display as long as, you know, we have room to put them, as long as they attach a little story that goes with each patch. So, yeah, very much focused on veterans and their service.
So this started in
2019.
So you're real young.
It's a very young organization and a very young institution. It went 2019, 2020, and then in 2021, they switched gears a little bit and brought me in. There's a few things that brought the benefit with. For instance, we're on the cusp of becoming accredited by the American Alliance of Museums. That might not sound like much, but in the United States, 2% of museums successfully get accredited and 98% fail. And that's largely because it's very stringent in their rules and guidelines and policies and ethics that have to be followed. We just heard, about 3 weeks ago that our core documents had been accepted, which means the only thing left to do now is wait for our certification. So we're going to be the first and the only museum in Gettysburg that is accredited.
So all the paperwork's done, all the reviews are done, they just got to get all the paperwork done and decide that they're going to give you the certificate of accreditation.
Correct. The process after it's normally a 5-year process. Now, a little honest disclosure. In my previous position, I worked in the capacity of maintaining our accreditation at that museum. And so I had kind of an insider insight as to what they were looking for. So it's usually a 5-year process, and it's a back and forth. You'll submit these plans and ideas and core documents, they're called, and then there's a back and forth to adjust them to meet their standards. The national standards that they produce are about 400 pages, so a pretty thick catalog you've got to meet. Because I had a lot of experience in that, we've shortcut that, then we applied in 2023, and we'll be accredited in 2024.
Give me an example of something that you need to have to be accredited?
Well, that's a really good question. So one of the things that to become accredited is, I'll use this as a good example because it's near and dear to my heart, is you have to have a core ethics policy. And that lays out very specifically things the museum may and may not do, and more importantly, what members who work or volunteer or are on the board, for example, at the museum, have to do to make sure we're maintaining ethical clarity. And that is the biggest fail point for most museums.
It is.
It's amazing. There are museums that I will not mention that are run by very big organizations in town that have failed repeatedly and almost invariably on the ethics, not on their conservation plan and not necessarily on their strategic planning for the future, but on the ethics, because it's a tall order. It's a very transparent and very meticulous record keeping to make sure that when people, taxpayers, donate their money to the museum, they can be assured that it is going to be handled in an absolutely legal and ethical manner, and that's important.
So it's more like funding issue. It's a funding.
Yeah, when it comes to ethics, it has a lot to do with the funding, because to run a museum is not an inexpensive endeavor, and donors being the lifeblood of why we're still in business, if you will, is important to they have assurance and, you know, confidence that the money is going to be spent properly. because face it, a lot of small museums, especially like we are, sometimes things get kind of confused between what was a donation and maybe what an owner has in their pocket, as an example, and paying bills with that that might not be museum related. It's not uncommon in a small museum. There's certainly nothing illegal about that, but they would be an ethical question as to is, did those donors understand that that's what that would be used for.
You're using the money as expected.
Exactly. So it holds us to a higher standard. Our ethics also include our pledge to keep things in perpetuity. So when we get an object at the museum, the object is for us to keep that, preserve it, conserve it. It requires, you know, maintenance, if you will, to keep that in good shape. And that is something that is a very long-term commitment. And then there's even specifics in there if the museum for some reason would have to close. We're very limited as to what that closing, how that works, who gets what, and that sort of thing.
Okay, so they deal with ethics. They deal with what else?
Well, they deal with what's called your I don't want to get too technical. The term is the collection management policy.
Okay.
So as an example, a lot of people don't understand that this is really a great opportunity for the public to kind of come inside and see what museum people do. One of the things we have to look at a museum, I'll use an example, like if somebody wants to donate something to us, it seems like that would be simple enough. I've got this really cool thing, I want to give it to the museum, and the museum, you would think, would be okay. But in reality, what happens is if somebody wants to donate an object, an original firearm, or an original camping implement, we actually have a very strict policy we have to go. We'll accept it, but not as a donation yet. And then I have, as the director, start a very long process. I have to prove its provenance. I have to check international law to make sure there's no material in there that would be like sites prohibited. For example, a lot of people say, I've got this ivory-handled pistol. Well, if it's elephant ivory, you have to have a site certificate, or it's technically illegal and has to be returned to the country of origin. Or if it's something that from antiquity could have been stolen, for example. And you can see a lot of that with what the Germans were doing near the end of World War II, kind of gobbling up a lot of art and artifacts. And when they make their way to the museums, there's a very set course of what we must do to ensure it's legal, it's ethical, it's original, and that it hasn't been stolen, which is that provenance, that the line of ownership, or if you will. Mm-hmm. And all of that has to be proved over a course of 60 days generally, and only then would we go back to the donor and say, okay, we're willing to accept this donation to the museum of an object.
So you have 60 days to get the history of that.
It's a lot of work. Yeah, that's us trying to be reasonable. The national standards say you can take up to a year. I don't really think that's fair, especially if it's a valuable object, to tell somebody, well, we'll let you know in a year if we're going to keep it or not. So it's kind of our internal clock is 60 days, and we've maintained that so far. So it's a lot of work, but that's the one good example of how much more a museum is than just a collection of stuff.
So now we talked about the finances for accreditation. We talked about the objects for accreditation. What else is the accreditation organization concerned about in order to make sure that you are 100% a solid organization?
Well, one of the things that they had to do, and it's a very early step, is there are certain requirements for people to meet certain degree or credential requirements. Some of those would include an advanced degree, above a bachelor's degree. Some of them would include specific things like, are you accredited by a professional credentialing organization? So in my case, I have a PhD, so I met the criteria for an advanced degree. I'm also in the Registry of Professional Archaeologists, and that is a credentialing body that maintains really high standards for doing archaeology, which is my specialty. So in that case, it was pretty easy for us because we only had a staff of one, and that being me, so that was easy to prove. But as we grow, that is part of our consideration, is we can hire guides to come in who are just very knowledgeable laypersons, and there's nothing wrong with that, but we have to keep a specific percentage of credentialed professionals on staff to maintain the accreditation. So that's another good example.
So the Lomas Center Museum it will be accredited, it looks like it. It will be the only accredited museum in Gettysburg, which is interesting enough.
It is.
But one component that makes the museum sparkle, shine, is you, Michael. You have your PhD. You have years as an archaeologist. You have experience working in another museum. Can you give us a little history of your background?
Well, I have a very interesting background, and I would say I've got a long track record of failures that led me to something that was a success. So right out of college, basically, I went into the military. And so I did my time in the military, and like so many people, I came out of that and went into law enforcement. And I was thinking that might be a career. I enjoyed the work. It's noble work. But one of the things that I did along the way, wanting to advance perhaps to a detective or an officer, you know, they recommend you get a college degree. And I thought, well, you know, anthropology sounds really good because they do crime scene investigations and that sort of thing. And along my way to my bachelor's in anthropology, I realized I just had this tremendous love for archaeology and for, ancient history. And so I believe it was like at year 12 or 13, I discussed it with my wife, who was a nurse at the time, and we talked about the financial burden that would happen if I walked away from a career and went back to school at 26 years old. But we decided it was a good thing to do, so then I got my master's degree at Vermont College, which was a lot of fun, and then I got my PhD at the University of Leicester, which is actually in the UK. And the result of all that is when I came back from there, I got hired in a large museum in Virginia, and that's kind of where I started. I also own a small business that we do archaeological consulting. My specialty is geophysical remote sensing, so we do a lot of ground-penetrating radar. In the marine environment, we do side-scan sonar and bottom profiling. So we kind of got a lot of tentacles out there for a small company, but between that and the museum, it keeps me pretty busy. But that's kind of the path that led me to being at the Lomas Center Museum.
And I know Pete's sitting over there and he's being very patient. And we may be wondering, okay, what's Pete's association with Lomas Center?
That's a great question, and I'll turn it over to Pete here after I give the brief introduction, although it's quite large. One of the things that we were lacking is any sort of social media presence. They had a Facebook page that had not a lot of followers, and that was it, and it was not really generating any interest. And so early on, I identified we need to get an IT professional who could help us with that, and Pete is the guy who got the job for that, and since then we've grown to a really swell website and a Facebook page that's actually pretty active and gaining a lot of followers. We do a blog, we do a YouTube channel, mm-hmm. cast of things now, where people can log on and see interesting little topics about things at the museum. So he's really taken it to the next level, and going forward, he's going to be in charge of all our QR coding. All of our objects will have a QR code, so someone can scan and get the story on that if they don't want to take a guided tour. They would rather walk through themselves. Or if they're hearing or sight impaired, there's going to be tools in there to help them. And then we have the Teacher Institute, which is going to be very internet-based. We're going to host teachers coming in to learn and get their contact hours, for continuing ed, if you will, how to talk about things related to military history, give them some tools and some ideas, and a lot of videos, which is where you guys are gracious enough to help us with, for a video library where people who might not be able to afford to send a teacher from their district in for a hands-on workshop can do a Zoom workshop with us, or can just reference our video library.
Homeschooling also.
Homeschoolers, we're hoping really dig that, because they're all designed around the national curriculum. with STEM and STEAM, which are the terms that you have to bake into everything you talk about these days. Well, we're managing to do that. And so if you're a homeschooler, those will be available. Just log on to the website. And
Mike, you made a great decision with Pete.
I did. He's my number one guy.
So, Pete, tell us your impression of Lomas, and then how close to your heart you got your excitement about the opportunities they're giving you. Because I'm sure not only the technical aspects, which I know you're going to be great at, but this must be exciting also because of the topic, the theme.
Yeah. So when I first came into it and was introduced to Lomas Center, I was much like you. I had no idea it was there. Went in and Michael showed me around, and you know, you and I have had this conversation before. Graduated from Gettysburg High School, and as a teenager, you pretty much are like, tourist, get out of my way. I'm trying to get to my job or high school, whatever. And you kind of neglect the history in Gettysburg for a number of years, but in my late 20s, early 30s, it started to come back that I had an interest in Gettysburg. And that's kind of what I really like about the Lomas Center is the Gettysburg aspect and the overarching aspect of the military history that they're making available to everybody and educating everybody on. They don't sugarcoat the experiences of the wars for people. I mean, it is what it is. It doesn't need to be sugar-coated or manipulated in the presentation. You know, this is what it is. Here's what happened. And that's what kind of really, really I like about working with them and being a part of this. And of course, you know, I build websites and I do all that technical stuff in the background, and that's just something I do. And as my company's grown, I've had the ability to pick and choose who I choose to work with, and this is one of the clients that I really enjoy working with.
And the exciting thing is you're helping to take Lomas Center to a new technical level in immersiveness of the experience and also accessibility of the experience.
Right. I mean, Michael pretty much reviewed everything that's kind of on the plate to do. We're just dipping our toe into the first steps of the QR coding. The Teacher Institute's going to be a big one. That's going to be interesting and easy to pull off, but it's going to be time-consuming to do. But yeah, I mean, it's just it's a fun project.
So the vision, Michael, is right now someone can come to the Lomas Center Museum, which is located where?
That's at 50 Mayor Alley, right in Gettysburg. So if you're familiar with, it's kind of like between Steinway and Baltimore. The Farnsworth house is there. It's kind of directly behind that on the alley. So that's our biggest challenge is our location. It's kind of hard to find, but well worth finding.
And you have definitely a website, like Pete has said. And what is the website?
LomasCenterMuseum.org.
.org. Okay. So people can find information there also.
Yes.
And if they wanted to get in contact with you, Mike, for any reason, they could just go to the website and do it that way.
Exactly. If you go to the website and log on to navigate to our website, there's a contact form, but there's also, I believe, a way to, you know, our phone number is listed.
Phone number, with Facebook our, page
and
link.
And an email. So any of those things, I actually do read them. And I'm really glad Pete brought something up here, because one of the things that is foundational to a good museum experience is museums tend to believe they have to be like warm, fuzzy places for people to go and learn about history. But the best research shows museums should challenge your beliefs. And that's what I think Pete was referring to. We don't sugarcoat anything, and we tell you how it really is. And
For example, the
development of what people would today call the gun culture, the people who endorse and want to use firearms and its history going back, and there's a lot of misinformation out there where it wasn't quite like that, and not everybody had a gun, and, you know, a lot of poo-pooing in the environment. But when you go back and look at colonial times, pretty much it was a required tool for survival, because if you didn't have a fowling piece, what we would today call a shotgun, you didn't eat. And if you wanted deer, for example, for skin so you could have, you know, clothes, you had to have a rifle. Mm-hmm. So these are things that are fundamental, but frankly make some people very uncomfortable talking about, or the sacrifices that soldiers, you know, have to make on a battlefield when we discuss a battle where there was, you know, losses. Some people don't really want to hear that, but, you know, that's a fundamental part of, you know, that sacrifice to better our country, to protect us, to forward our basic requirement for defense and what we stand for. It's all kind of intertwined with something as violent as, you know, a war. And so there's no easy way to sugarcoat that, though some institutions try.
And they do on TV.
And they do on TV very much. But our philosophy is, I want you to come to our museum and enjoy a lot of stuff, but I want you to hear some things that make you sit up and go, wow, I've never really thought about that. And it might even be a little uncomfortable, but you'll go away with a lot more knowledge and probably a broader appreciation for it.
Appreciation, you didn't have to go through that. If, I mean, some people have, you know, that, like, you served, but, you know, I just imagine often that right now there's a war going on somewhere, and there's a parent who just wants to take care of their family, but it's not safe, you know, and they're in a position where they have to protect their family and their beliefs and their nation. And that's not an easy thing. I mean, it's not an easy thing.
And you know, even in times of relative peace, people here are sleeping very comfortably in their beds at night, in relative peace compared to a lot of places around the world, because there are men and women who are ready to step in. And when you enlist, or in my case, commission into a military branch, you're basically writing a blank check up into your life to defend those people at home so they can sleep in their beds and have relative peace and safety. And that is one of the reasons we're very adamant about talking about the experience of the American warfighter and why that is important and still very much significant today to our safety as we sit here right now.
Yep, and at any moment, that can be challenged. That could be challenged. And you honor those individuals at Lomas Center Museum.
We do. You're going to find that we venerate veterans. We honor them. We thank them for a very large sacrifice. Even in times of peace, one of the things that I acutely was aware of is how much time I wasn't at home with a wife and two daughters. Mm-hmm. And you think about that, but at the end of the day, I'm allowing, you know, 50,000 other people to be at home with their wives and daughters. So
thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
But there's a lot of men and women that we owe a lot of thanks to.
One thing I misspoke on was the URL. When you run a business and have over 100 websites you built, it gets a little scrambled sometimes. It's lomascenter.org. is the URL for the website. Okay. And you can find us on Facebook at the Lomas Center Museum.
And people can go to your social media. They can find out when you're open.
Yep.
They can donate money.
Absolutely, there's a donate button there. They can also find for events, we have a special event, as you're aware of, coming up. And any event tickets, whether they're a cost, or we still run tickets for free events because we have to keep track of how many people. So that's a more logistic thing. So you can hit a buy ticket, but you're not really buying a ticket for some events. But for others, that, you know, you can buy the tickets right there online. I believe we also show that at Destination Gettysburg. Is that correct?
We're listed on Destination Gettysburg. Yep.
Calendar and everything as well.
So I want to get to the events shortly, but, you know, your hours are?
Well, we're closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, so we're open Thursday through Monday. The doors open at 10, and we're open till 5 p.m. every day of the week, and you have your choice. You can come and visit us and just walk around at your leisure and look at the objects, or you can follow one of our guides and take a a more guided tour and go that way.
And that's a great opportunity, is that a person can come in there and there's someone there that you could have a conversation with.
And another thing that's pretty important in today's economy, we don't charge any admission. So admission to the museum is absolutely free. That guide's going to take you through about a 30-minute tour of all the basics of the objects that are in there. We don't charge a dime. We do accept donations. If you feel that that's was worthwhile and something you want to support, we have a donation box there, or you can go online and click the button. But yeah, there's no admission. It's a free museum.
And what Pete is working with you is QR codes, so that when you go to the museum, you could just see an item and click on the code and
scan the code in your phone, and it'll take you to a destination page on the back end of the website that right now is going to be very text driven, but eventually there'll be videos added to those pages as well.
And we're looking forward to being part of that here at Community Media.
I can tell you, we're very happy to have you guys working with us. Absolutely.
And, you know, I want to thank Mark Worley, our vice president and station manager, who served in the military also, in the Marines.
Thanks, Mark.
Great character. You usually tell someone who served in the Marines. And, you know, some people who are just great leaders in the community. It takes a lot of dedication and accountability and leadership. So this is a great experience, the Loma Center. People can come here, walk through it. You'll have the QR. You'll have the technology that people throughout the whole world can interact. You'll have the technology that teachers can use your facilities in order to present various items and concepts and video, etc. What else makes your center unique?
Well, I would say that one of our strong suits, if you will, is we have some items that are of very great historic importance, in addition to monetary value. Our shining star of our collection is we have 3-inch ordnance rifle serial number 1. And we also have the original patent and a legal contract that kind of went with that patent with that gun. So it was the first of what would end up being the most ubiquitous federal field piece of the entire war. And it was made by Phoenix Iron Company, and owned by a gentleman named Samuel Reeves was the president. And him and Mr. Griffin, John Griffin, one of his associates, collaborated and developed what would become the most important and most iconic artillery piece of the war. And we have the first of that, the one that the patent was written on.
And George is the one who acquired that.
George acquired that in a interesting fashion. It's a long story, but if you come to the museum, we'll spell all that out. But it was a long process. He tried many years to acquire that from the individual. I think what also makes that particular piece appealing, many small arms and artillery through the course of the war changed hands. You know, the Confederates would capture guns, the Union would capture things back and forth. But one of the interesting things is artillery did not keep great records about that sort of thing, a loss or a gain. So while we know many, many guns exchanged hands, we have it documented when number 1 was lost. It was written by Wainwright, who was the local battery commander of the First Corps. But the even General Hunt, who was the overall artillery commander, writes of the loss of gun number 1. And A.P. Hill talks about the capturing of gun number 1. And then if you fast forward, and that was July 1st, 1863, here at Gettysburg. If you fast forward to May of 64, Grant's in charge of the Army now, or Grant's in charge of all armies, Meade's in charge of the Army of the Potomac. They're heading to Richmond. They have a big battle in Spotsylvania Courthouse in Virginia. And there's this particular spot called the Mule Shoe, because it was shaped like a mule shoe, and it was studded with our artillery. It took Grant quite a few attempts to overrun that, but when they finally overran that position, it made it untenable, and the Confederacy had to continue its retreat towards, you know, Richmond. And when they got to the top of the hill, there was number 1, which they recaptured. So the interesting thing is it's the only gun in existence that is documented that it was lost, used by the other side, lost, and regained by that side. So there's only 1, and that's our number one. So it makes it kind of unique in a couple of ways.
And you have other unique
we
items
do.
That you would probably only see there. Right?
Exactly. I would say that two things I would highly recommend. I mentioned that there was Samuel Reeves and his superintendent, John Griffin. John Griffin designed a gun of his own that was the predecessor to the 3-inch ordnance rifle. And we have about 12 known examples in the world, and we have one of them sitting in our museum, which makes it really easy to tie the story of the development of number one, because it came from that gun. And then I'd say the other thing that's pretty impressive, we have a Gatling gun that is a reproduction Gatling gun, but is sitting on an original Gatling gun carriage. And as far as research has been able to show, both by us and by the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., is probably the last existing original Gatling gun carriage. So quite a few things to come that you won't be able to see anywhere
any
else.
Other place. Exactly. So, you know, your center museum, Lomas, is unique in many different ways, you know. It costs money to do anything, more or less run a museum, and you don't charge any money for people to come in. So you have people that donate, you have grants that you acquire.
Yes, we've applied for a number of grants since I've been here, and that's the piece of the puzzle where the accreditation also comes in. When you're accredited, your likelihood to get larger grants is exponentially increased because you've proven your trustworthiness and ethical standards and transparency
with money,
people tax, you know, free money from donors, and so that's kind of an integral part to going forward. But yeah, we survive pretty much on small grants right now, and the gracious donations of our followers and benefectors, and that's something Pete works on is expanding. And we have an e-blast list that goes out and. We tell them what we're looking for. And then, like I said, we have events like the one we've alluded to coming up.
Let's talk about some of the events that do. Let's talk about some standard events that you have yearly. Do you have, like, okay, in January, we usually have this event. Every January, you can look for this, or...
I would say yes and no. So, of course, the big dates, the July 4th weekend, we will always have programming. Remembrance Day weekend is another one we will always have programming over. But we have a series of speakers, as an example. We call them our scholars in residence, and they will do free lectures or talks, presentations on very specific topics that are deep. If you go to round tables or you go to a lot of places and hear a presenter, it's typically pretty topical. And we're trying to break that mold and provide things to the community where if they really want to dive deep, learn more about a subject at a much deeper level, and including things like the citations behind it that prove it. We have a series of speakers who will do that. And then we also host lighter topics. We have a couple of people who come out and do, one of them does a Civil War chaplain. And she's very good at it, and she's actually an ordained reverend in the real world. But she talks about the importance of the chaplaincy and does a program on how they were integrated with the Army and that sort of thing. And those are scattered throughout the year, and those are all found on our website.
And it's not always Civil War based.
It's not always Civil War based. So when we did, I think our last scholar in residence talked about the plans in 1941 that the Russians had drawn up to try to attack the Germans before they ended up attacking them. And that particular scholar, who's one of our guides, and has a PhD in Russian history, speaks fluent Russian, lived in Moscow about 5 years, and has made a career out of translating Russian documents. So when he speaks, it's from a very place of high authority, and people will say, well, where did you get that document? And he'll have it with them, and he'll read it to you in the Russian and then tell you what it says. And so we have deep dive folks like that, and then we have special events like the fundraiser we... want to bring up, which is a very popular Civil War band that is lucky enough to be doing a concert with us.
Yeah, and that is the 2nd South Carolina String Band. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Now, we're going to get into that, but before we do, I just want to emphasize you talking about the scholars and their lectures is a tremendous experience that someone can go through. And is there a cost for that?
Well, I would say 90% are free. Some speakers might bring the book that you could then purchase or that sort of thing. But we've pretty much gravitated. And if there's a fee for the speaker, the museum usually eats that. So those are usually just free to the public because we really want to encourage people to come in and get a deeper knowledge of very specific things about history. So we've got medical specialists who will be talking about some very particular things that the surgeons were doing and the doctors were doing beyond, oh, they took, saws and cut off limbs, mm-hmm. What they're actually doing, all the way to people who are like, literary majors who are talking about a new document and maybe a new way to look at it.
And this is lectures that go on throughout the year.
Yes, they're sprinkled throughout the calendar year-round.
And they're on your website.
They are on our website, and I think most of them end up on Destination Gettysburg.
Yeah, all the events we put on Destination Gettysburg as well.
So if you're just kind of looking to see what's going on in town, Destination Gettysburg is a great resource. Mm-hmm. And all of our stuff is generally on there as well.
Mm-hmm. So that's exciting. If you're looking for something to do, get on the website, check out a lecture. And if it's close to your heart, you'll have a great experience. So, Pete, I know you can agree with me that Adams County, this whole community is much better because Mike Nelson is now helping to celebrate and make the Lomas Center Museum a popular place to experience not only the Civil War, but the concept of war and all that is included in that. Pete, you have Sockham's Web Solutions again.
Yep.
And Pete's working with community media. If you're a nonprofit and you want to expand your social media reach, get a hold of community media or Pete and we work together to bring you an affordable solution to reaching out to the community so that you can provide your services, you could accomplish your mission, and hopefully find people who will come aside of you financially, if not physically, to make that possible. Because the great community is a connected community, mm-hmm. and everyone has something unique to give. And again, Mike, we're glad that you have brought your uniqueness to Adams County.
Well, I'm glad to have done so. I mean, museums are all about community. We're very invested in being in the community and staying here, and hopefully people will become invested in liking what we do.
Good. So, hey, we're at the end. I hope you enjoyed the show. Pete, is there anything you'd like to say before we leave?
I think you did a good job. As always, Ray, bringing out the information.
Thank you, Pete.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoy being with great people, good people. Would you like to say anything to everybody before you leave,
Mike? I would just say appreciate giving the Lomas Center a look. It's not an easy location to find, but I haven't had anybody that I've spoken to that said it wasn't worth walking down that alley to where we're located and seeing what we have to offer.
It's not hard to find.
It's not hard to find. It's not quite on the beaten path.
Right. It's not in your face, per se, but very easy to find behind the Farnsworth House. Thanks for spending time with us. We greatly appreciate it, and hopefully that you will build some time in your life to experience the Lomas Center Museum. And until we have our next segment, we can spend some time with some more great individuals doing great things here in our community. Be safe and be kind. And thanks for spending time here with Community Media.